The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with your weekly take on education news and views, and here with my co-host, always chock-a-block with pithy observations overflowing with sprezzatura, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
Wow, that is a serious old-school SAT word, baby.
I mean, now, sprezzatura, our writer Liam put that into the script. Do you know what that means?
I have not a clue, babe.
Liam, could you tell the listeners, please?
I believe it is the artful way of being artless.
Artful way of being artless. Rick Hess, if that does not describe you, what does, huh?
Where did you get that from, Liam?
Well, Rick, you know, it looks like there is a coup underway in Thailand, but who cares? I am worried about spinach. Are you a big spinach eater? You know, it's a good source of iron.
Mike, I don't even know where you're going here, baby, but I'm along for the ride. Hey, but we do have a special guest with us today, don't we?
Oh, we do. Who is that?
We got a high-ranking, well, kind of a mid-major ranking government official here.
That is correct.
With a word of wisdom or two.
That's right. We have not given him a microphone, but actually tell us this mid-major government official. Any words of wisdom for our listeners?
Stay in school.
Stay in school.
Can't argue with that.
Gotta love the government.
It's powerful advice.
Well, good, good, good. All right. Well, if you have anything to say about staying in school or about green vegetables, shoot us a line at letters@edexcellence.net. Let's get going, Rick. We're going to play a game of Pardon the Gadfly, of course. Then we'll have an interview with Art Levine, former dean of Teachers College.
Former president, no less.
Former president. My bad. Big report out on education schools this week. We're going to talk about that.
And you're going to have him in the flesh, man. That's... Now, you don't get that on just every radio podcast.
That is a big get. I know the Today Show was trying to get him. Nope.
Boom.
Education Gadfly Show. That's right. And finally, our weird correspondent, Liam, will serve up a dose of education news of the weird. So let's get started. We're going to try a new thing this week. Liam's going to lead off the Pardon the Gadfly. So, Liam, it's all yours.
More Liam is better.
Topic one. In this week's Education Gadfly, Frederick M. Hess points out that while charter school supporters are often busy trying to discredit the Phi Delta Kappa / Gallup poll of the public's attitudes toward the public schools, they're missing its useful finding, namely that most Americans are confused about the nature of charter schools. Even when nearly 1 million kids are enrolled in charters, 53% of respondents said charter schools were not public schools, and 50% think charter schools are free to teach religion. Mike, are charter advocates doing a lousy job of getting the facts out there?
Well, they are. They are. First of all, props to Rick for an excellent Gadfly piece this week.
Why, thank you, Beth.
So here's the problem. As your piece demonstrates, people just don't understand the basics about charter schools. And the fact that they think that charter schools are private and can be exclusive and can teach religion make them like charter schools a lot less. Now, is this because charter proponents aren't getting the word out, or is this because charter opponents are spreading misinformation? Mm. I mean, I don't think this is a mistake. I think a lot of people who are against charter schools have tried every way they can to argue to the public that these are private schools that are trying to make money off the backs of poor kids. And unfortunately, some of that message is getting through.
Yeah, and I think there's a key point here. It's not just people are misinformed or confused. It's that they're systematically wrong. 2-1, people told Gallup that charter schools are able to handpick their student bodies, that they're able to select them. Well, one, that's just illegal. That's false. They're not able to do this. And two, it means that if I come to you with results which say that charters are doing, you know, a bang-up job, your first impulse is going to be like, well, I'm not convinced, because anybody can do a bang-up job with kids who they get to select. So it's important that if we're actually going to have an honest conversation about the utility of charters, that folks actually understand what charters are and what they can do.
All right. So what do we actually do about this then? I mean, it's hard to impact public opinion, you know, if we've got charter school opponents out there hammering away at the idea that these are quasi-public or private schools. You know, what can charter proponents do? I guess we'll never know.
We'll have a cliffhanger, baby.
But it's just as well, because I don't think Rick had a good answer to that question.
That's not what I do. That's about making a difference.
Okay, topic two, Rick. Michael J. Petrilli, also writing in this week's Education Gadfly,
he's
posits that educators can learn from the recent hugger-mugger surrounding the comments of Pope Benedict XVI, Specifically, his allusion to the writings of a 14th century emperor who said that Muhammad had brought the world only, quote, evil and inhuman, unquote, things.
Now, how does Michael J. make this relevant to America's education discourse?
And why is it that popes and the Super Bowl are the only things in our society that still use Roman numerals? I mean, what's the combination?
What is a hugger mugger exactly?
Okay. So, Rick, we're going to have Liam.
It's a type of brouhaha.
Rick, if we're going to let Liam read this stuff, we got to let him read it.
Fair enough.
To continue. Just as the Pope hoped to show that wisdom is found in a convergence of reason and ideology, Petrilli hopes to show that the same holds true in the realm of education policy.
Ooh.
Rick, has our reliance on statistics and data obscured larger, more profound social and character beliefs that may underlie all educational pursuits? Or is Petrilli barking up the wrong tree?
I've hardly ever seen Petrilli bark up the wrong tree. Usually that's because when I see him bark, and it's usually drunk and indoors, so there's not a lot of trees around. But I think he's onto something here. I mean, when you think about the debates that we're most interested in, issues like accountability, how do you attract better teachers, how do you professionalize the school environment, ultimately, achievement gains are only going to measure a little bit of what we care about. What we care about is changing the way in which schools operate as organizations, the way that kids come out of schools. And ultimately, achievement gains over any 1 or 3 or 7 year period are only going to capture a slice of this. We've got to be talking about larger issues, about how we understand change to take place, about how the world works. And so I'm glad we got the Pope involved in the school wars to talk about these things.
But Rick, you've totally missed the point. I'm suspecting that you didn't read my piece. Is that
what
this means?
It's not out yet.
What are you talking about? But I sent you a copy, and by the time this airs, it'll be out.
Actually, I did read it, but I thought but there was a whole bunch of Liam fill the sins in it, so I'm still working on it.
No. Rick. Look, the piece is about faith and reason, right? And the argument is that there are some things in education, especially things about values, that you can't possibly decide based on empirical evidence. So, for example, what should students learn? Is it important for students to learn world history, or is it important for students to learn about geography? I mean, these are not things that we can prove empirically. What do we want students to be able to do in terms of behavior, in terms of character? These are issues that no scientific study is going to resolve.
Well, that's right. But see, what I did is I took it another direction. I took it my direction as well. It has implications in ways you might not have immediately envisioned.
Yes, Rick, because your direction always steers clear of anything that has to do with what happens inside the classroom.
Okay, our final topic.
Huh.
The Wall Street Journal recently featured a prominent article about wealthy parents who are withdrawing their children from private schools and enrolling them in the neighborhood public schools. Sure, these parents are saving some dough, but many of them are also convinced that little Muffy and Trip are receiving at local public schools an academic instruction of equal or greater value as that on offer at the nearby prep academies. Rick, what, if anything, can we glean from this article?
That the Wall Street Journal's grasp of education policy is dubious at best. I mean, I'm not sure which part of the story was supposed to be interesting or surprising. The whole point of school districts is that it allows folks who have the means to move into districts where they can use the public options. That's been part of the choice debate for decades now. So to find that people who have the means can afford to live in districts where they like the schools and then use those schools strikes me as something less than shocking.
What was shocking was that the Wall Street Journal actually mentioned this summer's NCES report on public versus private schools to say that, well, recent reports have shown that private schools are no better than public schools, and parents must be hearing this message and therefore pulling their kids out of private schools and sending them to public schools, which all seems very strange to me and unlikely. But
parents
are
moving quick, if that's the case, man.
I was just going to say, I know.
60 days, sell the house, move, rent it. My God.
I mean, the National Center for Education Statistics has much more power than we ever thought they did.
I had no idea. We got to give Schneider some bonbons, man.
All right, but let's assume that this is happening, that maybe there is a trend out there that more parents are choosing public schools over private in the very elite, affluent areas of our country. This doesn't really have anything to do with the larger choice debate, which is mostly about how can we give poor kids in the inner city more choices than they have
now. The Journal didn't have any evidence that people are doing this more or less frequently than they used to. They're just shocked that some people who could afford private schools are using publics, right?
More or less, that's right.
That's clever investigative reporting. Way to go.
All right. Well, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly. Liam, thank you for joining us for that segment. Now we turn to this week's interview, as I said before, with Art Levine, formerly president of Columbia's Teachers College, who talks with us about his new report on teacher education. Let's take a listen. Joining us today is Art Levine, former president of Teachers College and head of the Education Schools Project. We're discussing his new report, Educating School Teachers, which was released on Monday. Dr. Levine, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Pleased to be with you.
So, Art, this report has gotten a lot of well-deserved media attention. The headline in the New York Times article was, quote, report critical of training of teachers. And yet, as you write in your report, quote, this was neither the defense desired by some nor the attack sought by others when it comes to education schools. So let's start with this basic question. From your point of view, after doing this two-year study, what are ed schools' greatest failings, but also what are they doing right?
Okay. The best part of the study, the good news in the study, was that there are some very, very successful education schools around the country, and profiled four of them in the report. The problem is they're not the norm. And more common are schools in which the curriculum is in disarray, lack of clarity about what education school curricula is supposed to do and what they're supposed to achieve, found that they weren't preparing students adequately for the classroom, that there was a disconnect between clinical and academic instruction, the quality of research wasn't very high, and so on.
Wow. Well, that is quite a damning indictment. And I suppose these four schools that you profile then are doing the opposite. They're doing all of these things well.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there's been lots of discussion in the media and in the blogosphere about some of your criticisms of NCATE. In fact, you call in the report for a new accreditation body to replace it. So tell us a little bit about that. Why do you think NCATE is falling down in the job? And is this just an issue of NCATE not doing its work right, or is this a problem with accreditation?
I don't think it's a problem with accreditation. I think accreditation is a real important thing. It's a self-policing mechanism that every profession has. The problem with NCATE is really twofold. One is that the floor is too low, so that institutions that are of poor quality are getting accredited. We looked at 100 schools that have been ranked by U.S. News and World Report. Of the top 10, 3 were accredited. Hmm. Of the bottom 10, 8 were accredited. And that's the nature of the problem. The other issue is that NCATE doesn't involve the best schools in the country. And in order to have an accrediting system that works, you really need the top of the field helping to police the nature of the field. When the institutions involved are largely mediocre or less, what happens is the standards are mediocre or less.
So why is that, Art? Why don't the top institutions participate in NCATE?
Because you don't need it.
Okay.
In order to become a teacher, you don't have to come from an accredited school, in contrast to, say, medicine or law, so that there's no reason for them to go through it. The other reason is, as Deans explained, accreditation serves NCATE more than it does them, because they're joining a club that benefits from having them as members rather than joining a club from which they benefit.
So you just said, and you also say in the report, that you're worried about the floor being too low. And in fact, you go on, as much as you criticize education schools, you also have a lot of criticisms and concerns about alternative routes to certification. It seems like you're worried that this is going to open the field up to kind of being a Wild West. But tell us, why haven't we reached the point when school principals, who are now held accountable for raising student achievement, why haven't we gotten to the point where those principals can be trusted to choose the best people for the job, and we can move away from worrying about exactly the preparation teachers have gotten before they show up at the school principal's door?
It's a different kind of question, I think, than the one you posed. The real question is, what's the adequate training that one needs to become a teacher? We can have a whole pool of people, some of whom are adequately trained and some of whom aren't adequately trained. And the thing we don't know about the alternative routes is, what impact do they have on achievement?
Right.
Are they better? Are they worse? And the notion of letting these things proliferate without any evidence is troubling to me.
But so do you feel then that there is, that we're going to find out that there's one right way to train teachers? I mean, what if there are 10 different ways to train teachers, or 10 different routes that are all good ways of bringing people into the profession?
Then let 10 routes prosper. For me, there's no empirical evidence of the best way to do this. And I'd be happy to live by whatever empirical evidence we discover.
Right. And I guess the question then for policymakers is, do you need empirical evidence in order to create alternate routes, or do you need empirical evidence in order to defend a system, you know, that keeps out people unless they have a certain kind of training and a certain kind of certification? But that is the kind of question we're going to have to look forward to down the road. Art, any last words?
No. Let me respond to that, actually.
Okay.
And say that if we were talking about medicine, we certainly wouldn't make the case that a person who had basic science as an undergraduate and had real high verbal ability ought to be taken into the operating room and do brain surgery and learn how to do this bit by bit.
Right.
And the real question is teaching a profession or a craft?
Right. Right.
I think people need a lot of education before they become teachers, or they can learn it on the job, and for me it's a profession.
Right. No, that when and you make that point very clear in the report. At the same time, I think others would argue, I would argue that unlike medicine, we don't have a great deal of a research base in education, perhaps besides in early reading, to know that there's a certain amount of knowledge and skills that every teacher absolutely has to have in order to succeed in the classroom. And so until we have that knowledge base, for me, it's hard to justify keeping out people who might be very good teachers from getting into that classroom.
And for me, I just don't know if they're good teachers, and I don't want my kids to have them.
Understood. Okay.
Take good
care. Good. Well, Art, thanks for joining us on the show, and
my
I do
pleasure.
Hope to come back.
Sounds great. Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Rick, what do you think? Was this a fair report? Did you pull his punches?
I think basically it's a fair report. I think certainly one can take issue with some of the conclusions that come out of it, particularly the notion that we ought to be embracing five-year preparation and that we ought to be doing more preparation in doctoral programs. I'm not sure how sensitive that is to helping us get more folks in mid-career and later career come into the teaching profession, because it doesn't really address this issue of what happens if you didn't study to be a teacher starting with when you were 18. At the same time, I think he takes some hard looks at what's going on in ed schools. And the fact is that it's easy to do these kinds of studies when you're part of a commission and everybody gets to hide behind the commission's name. The fact that, Art took the step of doing this stuff, of putting his name out there and kind of taking the blowback. I think whether or not you agree with any given finding, that the guy's to be congratulated for, wading into this stuff.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, in the report, he's very careful to say that he's not going to make the critics of ed schools or the defenders of ed schools happy. He's going to try to go right down the middle, though it is hard not to notice that he is not a big supporter of alternate routes to education. And, when you look at some of the findings he came out with, you can't help but wonder, if some of the findings are that clearly people who go to more selective colleges, have stronger education, do better as teachers, that one way to do that is through alternate routes. But maybe we'll have to save that for the next Art Levine report.
I like it.
Okay. Well, it is now time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Who has, since the last segment, donned a Darth Vader mask? Would you please take that off, Liam? Wow.
Sorry, Mike. I'm trying to protect myself from germs, and the Vader mask was the best I could do on short notice. I'm worried because of what happened to the students at Broken Arrow Elementary School in Lawrence, Kansas. The school's science teachers ordered from a biological supply company a shipment of ladybugs, but the company confused their order and mailed the school a shipment of E. coli instead. Luckily, Broken Arrow received a non-toxic E. coli strain called Escherichia coli K12 slant culture, which is commonly used by students for observation under microscopes. School and district administrators reacted professionally. They removed the bacteria from Broken Arrow premises, and they dispatched the specimen with a bucket of bleach. And throughout the whole ordeal, Superintendent Randy Westman was Mr. Cool. He said, quote, "I suppose all of us, at one time or another, have ordered one thing and received another." Which is so true. Just last week, I ordered some books to review for the Gadfly. The mail came, yada, 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 and now I'm pretty sure I have Ebola. Rick, what's with all the pathogens in the news?
Man, so you can actually dispatch E. coli with just some bleach? Who the heck would have known that? Did you know that, Mike?
I did not know that.
Man, this is why we need more scientists and engineers. These things crop up in everyday life. You know what it makes me think of, right? They've got this new show on CBS, Jericho, right? Kid goes home to Kansas, sees mushroom clouds over the horizon. The world's come to an end. He's, right? Who the heck in that community is equipped to know how to deal with fallout, E. coli? You need local engineers and scientists. Are we really thinking about this enough as part of the competitiveness initiative?
Well, I think those are all excellent questions. And I want to congratulate Superintendent Westman, who really seemed to, you know, could have panicked. You know, they could have caught, you know, brought in the Centers for Disease Control. It could have been a lot of mayhem.
Have been one of those whiners. No, you got to like that, man. I suppose all of us at one time or another have ordered one thing and that's...
So, and you got to love the fact that, you know, the greater danger in school that day wasn't that the kids would have dealt with E. coli around the microscopes, but that they would have eaten some spinach in the lunchroom cafeteria.
That's true. But, you know, but this guy, man, he just kept focused on achievement.
Very nice.
You can tell it.
Well, again, congratulations, Mr. Superintendent. And I hope that you will keep your cool and join us again next week, because this is all the time we have for now. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Till then...
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.